and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Women in America, Changing Roles, Challenging Times, Defining the Future. Inspired by the world premiere of Mrs. President at the Anchorage Opera, this panel discussion was hosted by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in partnership with the Anchorage Opera and recorded in the Alaska Public Television Studios on Monday, September 24th. APRN's news director, Lori Townsend, served as moderator of the panel, including former Senator Arlis Sturgiluski, sitting Senator Betty Davis, former Anchorage Assembly Chair Jane Amvick, former Senator Georgiana Lincoln, former Representative Cynthia Tuohy, and composer Victoria Bond.
Well, good evening, and thank you for being here for a discussion that I'm really honored to be a part of. My name, for those of you who don't know me, is Lori Townsend, and in my professional life, I work as the news director for the Alaska Public Radio Network and Alaska Public Telecommunications. And although I'm proud of my position and the terrific network that I work for, my having this job is not particularly noteworthy in a country where women today are lawmakers, such as a lot of our esteemed panelists, and CEOs of major corporations, doctors, lawyers, and university presidents. But it wasn't that long ago that things like that would have been unheard of. In a world of Victoria Woodhull, in the world of Victoria Woodhull, the fascinating pioneer we're going to be discussing this evening, women could not own property or have their own money in the early part of the 19th century. It still amazes me that women could not vote in the United States until 1920. That really wasn't that long ago. It was only 20 years before that that women were granted rights to own property in their name. Of course, they had to be married to do so. And the rights for women of color, as I'm sure we'll hear from Senator Davis and former Senator Lincoln this evening, were won much, much later. And still, with all that we've achieved collectively, there's so much work that remains to be done. We'll be discussing that work and what our panel envisions for the future of women. I'm excited to hear that. Before we look forward to the progress yet to be made, let's review where we've been. Tonight, we'll be discussing the little-known pioneer in women's rights and the first woman to run for president when such an idea was completely unthinkable, Victoria Woodhull. She was a newspaper owner, a proponent of women having control over their lives, a woman who rebelled against the injustice of women being considered chattel or merely the property of men, and decided she was going to do something about it. Let's start with introductions of our panel this evening, and then we'll learn more about Victoria Woodhull. Let's start with former Senator Arlis Sturgiluski. Would you tell us a little about yourself?
Be very happy to. I've had 60 wonderful years here. I came up as a young woman, single, pioneer family, but really was blessed. There were just the beginning of the Korean War, there were jobs everywhere. I had three or four job offers the first week, and I stayed in this place and have come to love it and married, lost a wonderful husband through an air crash, raised a son. But it's been exciting and a wonderful place for women, but it's been changing for the better over the years.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Senator Betty Davis. Senator Davis is currently a senator, and so she's the only panelist that we have this evening that is a sitting senator. Senator Davis?
Thank you very much. I've lived in Anchorage now for 40 years this year. Never thought I would end up here. I was born in the South. I didn't have any desire to come to Alaska because of the cold weather. I married my husband, and he got stationed here, so we came, and we were going to do our 3 years and go back home and never come back this way. And so we lived on the base the whole 3 years that I was here. I did work at Alaska Psychiatric Institute as a nurse social worker out there with the children's program. Later moving to health and social services because I have a degree in social work. But it got to be to the point where I did join a church downtown And I got to know a lot of people in Alaska and became very familiar with them and wanted to know more about them. So when we had our 3 years tour, we did leave. But we immediately asked to come back here. As soon as my husband got to his next base, which was in California, he put in to come back to Alaska. Great. And it was a great thing for me because I was following my husband around, so I'd never had an opportunity to build up any retirement. But I came here and worked for the state. I built up those 3 years, and they said you come back within a five-year period, you keep to maintain those 3 years. So I did. I got back before the 5 years was up, and I've been here ever since.
Wonderful.
Never thought I was going to end up in politics, but I've always been involved with children, families, and my start started on the school board. I served on the school board for 9 consecutive years. That's as long as you could serve. And actually, someone asked me if I would run for the state house. I had no interest in it at that time, and I said, probably not. But I thought about it because I was thinking at the time we were not getting enough money for education. Why not? And so I did put in for that, and they had about 20 names turned in, and they had to pick one person to take that seat. I got chosen. They said if I would say that I would run when the seat was up, then they would give me that seat. And they did, so I served in it for 6 months, and then I ran for the seat. And I enjoyed serving on the school board and doing the things that I was doing, so the time went awful fast. And at that point, like I said, someone did approach me about going to Juneau, and I served over there for 6 years in Juneau in the state house. And at that time, the Democrats were in charge the first 2 years I was there, and they haven't been in charge since. So that was a disappointment. But after 6 years on, and you have to run every 2 years if you're in the house, I decided that I would come back home and do something else. And what I actually did was come back and run for the school board again, and served another 3 years. And at that time, I decided to run for the state senate. And I've been in the state senate for the last 12 years.
Thank you very much, mm-hmm. Senator Davis. Now, former Assembly Chair Jane Anvik.
Hello. I'm delighted to be here today, and these are my friends, and I am really honored to be in a panel with people who have inspired me for almost 40 years. I've been here almost 40 years now also. My story is really probably comparable to many other women, which is you came, in my case, from a family where our mother told us it was really important to do well in school and to work hard. Our mother was also, I have four sisters, and she said, girls can do and be anything they want to be, and we think that that should be successful. So I actually was surprised at later in life to find that people thought, all people did not agree with that.
Right.
And that many of the people who did not agree with that happened to be men. And that, and so it was fascinating to pass through a wonderful life of working professionally in the area of city and regional planning and community development, which at that time was very much a male field. And so I had the opportunity to come to Alaska in 73 and worked as a city planner for then the Greater Anchorage Area Borough. And the city and the borough were in constant conflict with one another. They sued each other regularly.
Right.
And so in 75, as a young pup, led by my colleague Arla Sturgiluski, we participated in writing a new charter for the municipality of Anchorage, got to run for office, and served on the Charter Commission, where we unified the former city and the former borough into one government. And my principal motivation was I had been working on community plans and noticed that when it came time for development to actually occur, they sometimes just threw those plans away. And that it was really important that people have the ability to be able to influence what happens in their community at a neighborhood level as well as a citywide level. I then had the opportunity to work for the Alaska Federation of Natives and spent 5 years working on water and sewer and housing projects all over Alaska, which provided a completely different lens of who Alaskans are and what our lives are like. and then had the opportunity to work with communities from tiny little villages of 50 people to big metropolitan communities like Bethel, where there were almost 8,000 people.
Yeah.
I also had the opportunity then to work for the state government and got to work on citizen participation when Jay Hammond was the governor on the development of a program called the Alaska Public Forum, where we did community meetings all over the state around the question, the pipeline is about to be finished, we're about to get rich. Do you think we should save any of the money that comes from the development of oil? Do you think we should create a permanent fund? And so my sense of who we are in a democracy is we are a whole community of voices that get to try to influence the direction of the government. I then went on and had opportunities to either work with nonprofits or with government agencies. I married a wonderful fellow, had a daughter. She's now, I'm a grandmother. And all I can say is that the notion that a woman can pursue economic self-sufficiency, that a woman can pursue the capacity to take care of her family, her children, to own property, are gifts that we sometimes forget didn't used to exist. So I am really looking forward to the opera. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Georgiana Lincoln.
Thank you. I want to thank whoever is responsible for inviting me to be on the panel. I've worked with all of these great ladies and just met Victoria Bond, who I'm very pleased to meet. These are my friends as well. And it's really astonishing because when I think back on... Well, first I have to say that I didn't know quite what the forum was, and I looked to Arliss to give me some advice, and she said, So maybe that's good that we came here with the slate clean and just to say what we've experienced. I don't think Cynthia can top me. I've been in Alaska since for 69 years.
I'm second.
I was birthed in Fairbanks because we were living in Rampart, which is a very small village. So my mother had a choice of Fairbanks or Tanana. So I think she went to the big city to have me. And... I was going to say that my experience and sitting here at this table is a very, I think, very reflective that we as women can sit here as R's and D's, and we sit and we roll up our sleeves and we talk about the issues and how do we get them resolved. My experience in all my years is that men challenged me, which was good. Because every time I got the challenge, I went, okay, we'll see about that. And women helped me. And I think that that still goes on today, except for Vic Fishu, who is always helping everybody. And I have to just acknowledge my good buddy Vic sitting here in the audience. I was very naive. I grew up in Rampart, which was a village of, I thought everybody was brown. Didn't know that there were really people of color. And in the fourth grade, much to my dismay, when we were forced to move to Fairbanks, I learned about discrimination and hatred and racism. And I truly, and I know when I tell this story, people say, oh, that can't be. But I was the one in the back of the room, in the classrooms, that didn't say a word, was never called on, because I guess I wasn't supposed to know the answers. So I was quiet through high school. Never had a date.
Ooh.
Went through high school. Isn't that sad?
Well, it's hard to believe.
It was quite an experience. And then I lived in Fairbanks the whole time. And when I graduated, The Fairbanks Native Association had just begun in 1960-61. And so in 1963, I became involved. And we became involved around issues like education, health, social justices. And it was truly an eye-opener. So then I went on to work with Tanana Chiefs Conference, which is 43 villages. And then somebody suggested that I, much like Betty, that I run for the House of Representatives in 1990. And I had always been in politics, never realized it, but always been in politics, and said no. And then decided, after much urging by the villages, that I would go ahead. And much to my astonishment, I won the seat quite handedly. And then 2 years later, and that was the glorious 2 years that I served with Betty in the majority, and I thought, oh, this is great. I didn't know. I mean, I've been a minority all my life, but then to be in the majority? So then I decided to run for the Senate 2 years later and won that seat quite handedly and took half of the state of Alaska. I had, I think, close to 200 villages and communities. I was reminded by a gentleman here tonight that I served much of the pipeline, including Valdez. And then I ended up with a shifting to go into Metlakatla in the Tlingit country. And they're used to stealing Athabascans anyway, so that was good. And then I decided after 14 years that maybe it was time to retire. But I haven't done a good job on that. All I did was I left a $24,000 a year position, because that's what was paid, to zero and working double time. So I serve on the board of Alaska Federation of Natives and the First Alaskans board and a number of other advisory boards. But I'm excited.
Well, thank you, Senator Lincoln. And we're going to skip down to the end and then come back to Victoria. So, good. Representative Cynthia Tuohy, would you tell us a little about yourself?
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be on this dais with the rest of you ladies. I came to Alaska in 1957 to look for a husband. And Bonnie is going to say, oh, you shouldn't say that. Anyway, I picked him up in a bar in Talkeetna, and he was the handsomest thing in the North Slope. He was just gorgeous. And we were married, and we lived at Crow Creek Mine in Girdwood for 22 years. Unfortunately, he died in 1985 from cancer. But I raised my children out there. We fished together. I was a fisherman. I'm a gold miner. I went back to school and got my degree up here as a nurse, and I've been a nurse ever since. And Bonnie was one of the ones that suggested I run for office. So, good or bad, thank you. Now, this lovely lady who is on her fourth opera.
Yes, let's hear now from the woman who is the creator of this amazing operatic story that we're talking about, Victoria Bond. I think it's fantastic that you and your subject share the same first name. I think that's a great deal of fun. Tell us how you started researching Victoria Woodhull's life. It's my understanding that your mother had something to do with that, which is also
actually,
kind of nice.
My mother suggested the idea of an opera based on Victoria Woodhull. She had been traveling in San Francisco and stayed at a hotel that had a little plaque that said, Victoria Woodhull, first woman to run for president, slept here. That's all. And that's what started the whole thing. And I come from a long line of pioneer women. My grandmother was born in Israel before it was Israel. She was born in a tent and rode a donkey to school. And my mother was a child prodigy who was touring Europe when she was a teenager. So the idea of strong women was something that was from birth blazoned in my brain. And empowering women is something that I feel is very much a mission. And I'm very happy to be an advocate, especially when the arts pertain to present-day life. And the idea of Victoria Woodhull and what she wanted to accomplish, the fact that she never got any votes and was never elected president, is really beside the point. And in a certain respect, at the end of the opera, which was not the end of Victoria Woodhull's life, but when she is in jail, because she was in fact jailed on the night of election for sending obscenity through the mail, which the obscenity was basically revealing Henry Ward Beecher for the philanderer that he was. And so when she's in jail and she has been abandoned by all of her support, this to me is her moment of greatest strength, because this is when she says, I will never get where I want to go, but there will be people that come after me, and they will pick up my ideas. And we have such a perfect example of that right in front of us here. And the work, of course, is never finished, because even though women have made enormous strides in this country, there's still much further to go in our own country and certainly around the world. I read in the headlines every day about abuses against women, about the fact that a woman doesn't have the right to her own body, that women are not allowed to drive. There are still many places where women can't vote. The abuses against women are legion. And I think it's important for all women, particularly young women, to know the power that they have and to be able to move forward. And I think it's extraordinary for the arts to be able to be a part of society and to make a meaningful contribution, not only for the beauty of the arts, but for the meaning, the purpose of the arts. And opera, because it combines music and singing and the dramatic arts and, of course, a story, and in this case, history, I think is the perfect medium in which to convey a message like this.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with former Senator Arlister Jaluski, sitting Senator Betty Davis, former Anchorage Assembly Chair Jane Anvik, former Senator Georgiana Lincoln, former Representative Cynthia Toohey, and Victoria Bond, composer of Mrs. President, the story of Victoria Woodhull, set to make its world premiere at the Anchorage Opera in October. Recorded on Monday night, they all took part in a panel discussion moderated by Lori Townsend on Women in America, Changing Roles, Challenging Times, Defining the Future.
I'm going to stay with you just for a few moments, Victoria. Victoria Woodhull was a woman of quite a number of firsts, not only running for president, but she was also the first woman to sit on the New York Stock Exchange.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Very interesting story. Victoria Woodhull heard voices, and one of her spirit voices told her to go to New York and to meet Cornelius Vanderbilt. Now, most of us would say, well, that's a crazy idea. She was born in Homer. I know there's a Homer, Alaska, but this was Homer, Ohio. She was really poor. And for her to pick up, particularly at that time when women didn't travel around by themselves, to go to New York and to think that she could meet the most powerful financial capitalist of the day is pretty amazing. And the most amazing thing is that she did, and he did. And he met Victoria and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, because he consulted spiritualists in making his stock decisions, which, you know, when you think about certain other people in not too far history, not too far back, this is not absolutely outrageous, but he did. And he set them up on Wall Street with a brokerage firm, and it was sort of, it was a cute idea. I mean, the Bewitching Sisters, they were called. And there's a picture of them in the newspaper in their beautiful gowns driving a chariot that's pulled by bears and bulls. So it was kind of a joke, but the joke was on them because they ended up making a lot of money. They were very successful on Wall Street, and they made enough money to finance her campaign, to buy a an elegant house in New York, and her family all moved in, as did her former husband. And this, of course, was a very controversial because she lived not only with her present husband, but with her former husband, who couldn't take care of himself and was the father of her children. So she basically financed all of this. She also started a newspaper, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, which also was an expose of all of the corrupt politics that was going on, and was the first newspaper to print the Communist Manifesto in the United States. Pretty controversial. And so she did not shy away from controversy.
When you were writing the opera, what did you want people to learn or take away beyond just recognition of this fascinating woman in history? What were you hoping that people would come away with?
A woman who had confidence in herself and in her mission. I think that, to me, is really the message. In the opera, she comes head-to-head with the most powerful religious, political, financial leader of her day, Henry Ward Beecher, who was saying the right things and having affairs with his female parishioners on the side, under the radar screen. And so she threatens basically to expose him, and that is really sort of where this controversy is going. But she was not intimidated, and to me that is sort of the beginning, not to be afraid of confronting the power that be and fighting the good fight and not being afraid. And, you know, you could say she lost because she was never president, but I think she really won.
And she was a proponent of what she called in that day free love, which, of course, was different than the 60s version of free love. But she seemed to practice her own beliefs about that free love. She married three times. Have you found much in researching her life about her married life? I wondered if her three goes at marriage were a reflection of her strong-willed nature, which may not have been very palatable to her 1800s husbands.
Well, I dare say if anyone were running on a platform of free love today, they would get a very hard time. Actually, the term free love really encompassed something that we would take for granted today, because women did not have the right to their children. They could get divorced, but they could not keep their property. They really had no rights. And so free love was the freedom, if you fall out of love with somebody, to dissolve that relationship. Something which I think we very much take for granted today. The freedom to love and the freedom to fall out of love and to dissolve the relationship. So it was not a free-for-all. It was not a love-in in the 1960s, as you mentioned, but rather something that we think of as our inalienable right as women today. And the fact that she had several husbands, well, her first husband, she had, as I said, a very poor background. She was considered a child medium, and her father was sort of a charlatan who dragged her from town to town, touting her as a child medium. And she really wanted to get out of that kind of circus environment. And so she married Canning Woodhull, who was a doctor, and she thought this was going to be a good, stable relationship. He turned out to be an alcoholic and a womanizer, and it was a dreadful relationship. And she really felt stuck for a long time. And so she knew from firsthand experience what it was like to be in an abusive relationship. And then she met Colonel James Blood, who was a very enlightened person. And so that's why she divorced her husband, who I said earlier came to live with her once she had a big mansion and a lot of money. And she felt she needed to take care of him because he couldn't take care of himself. So that's why she divorced him and married Blood. And then when she was jailed numerous times, actually, not only once, her husband left her, her friends abandoned her, and she picked herself up. She went to England. She was on speaking engagements, and she met, as it turns out, a very wealthy Englishman who married her, and that's why she was married three times. There's a wonderful picture of her towards the end of her life driving a motor car, not being a passenger, but driving a motor car in England in a very baronial mansion. So she had many different lives and a very, very colorful, never shying away from controversy.
Well, thank you for that explanation of her life. And let's fast forward a bit now from the struggles of the 1800s woman to today. Certainly it can be said that there has been tremendous progress made, evidenced here by this panel of wonderful professional women who are very clearly in charge of their own lives and futures. But if we look around the world, as Victoria had mentioned earlier, this is certainly not the case. Just over the weekend, Iran announced new laws that are going to prohibit women from taking certain university courses. In other countries, women are stoned for adultery, sexually mutilated in attempts to make them easier for their men to control and trust. Women are still locked into arranged marriages. When you look outside of the United States, what do you consider the most egregious situations in the oppression of women, and how do you think that can be addressed or changed? And anyone can answer the question. Yes, Representative Tom.
I was asked by my son, now don't say anything, Mom. Now that, and just think about that. How many of you sitting here had the same reaction by your kids? It's very interesting, because he would rather I just be very quiet and go about my duty. And, of course, I won't do that, and I never have. But I think that the main thing that all of us have here, we are mouthy women. We have the confidence to take care of ourselves, and not only that, to tell other people to be quiet. I think it's a wonderful. I admire all of you, because we've all been through basically the same things. And the issues that come up today are the issues that we've been fighting for 20 years, 30 years. The abortion issue is a very big one on my plate, as I was a pro-choice Republican. Now, that is an oxymoron. And they were the men, I give them credit, they were very respectful while I was down there. We very rarely brought it up. If it was brought up, I closed it right now. But it was very interesting. But it is underlying the whole atmosphere that we all have is, don't say anything, Mom. Don't say anything. Don't make waves.
Yeah, I think that
this is such, it evolves. It's evolutionary. And I think what's going on in many parts of the world, that's that same thing. I think that the battles have been fought in many places in Europe and certainly in this country. But it's changed so much. I'm going to be 85. In my lifetime, I've seen tremendous changes where my mother, a gifted woman who died sadly when I was young, she was not able to teach. She had a degree from what they called a normal school, a two-year university. And so she gave reading, she provided entertainment for the community. But I thought, how sad. And I think that we should never kind of overlook the power of people that encourage us. And wherever we have contacts, and all so many of the people I see in this audience travel around the world, carry that message about strength, be an example to others. Things change more rapidly, perhaps, in this country than many places. And it's a sad story. It will not change overnight, but I can only hope it'll be evolutionary for the good.
That's a hopeful note. Former Assembly Chair Jane Anvig.
I wanted to mentioned that in 1995 I had the privilege to attend the International Women's Conference in Beijing. And the question you pose with respect to what's happening across the globe in relation to women is really important. And so today, in preparation for this evening, I went and looked at the progress that had been made since 1995 when thousands of women came together from across the globe to talk about what is the status of women? And the big issue then and today was poverty. And any time you had the capacity to be able to feed yourself and your children, because most women are finding themselves feeding children. And so poverty was number one, and the capacity to have some modicum of influence over your economic well-being was absolutely number one, followed very closely by education. And what happened with education is the capacity to be able to pass that on to the children. Mm-hmm. And so when they talk about raising up a woman to raise the sky, what you end up with is generational influences when your children have the opportunity to be educated because your mother is educated and the capacity to read and be able to discern information. And what was really interesting to me at the time, I was very much into women's rights associated with political process and equality, gender equality, and representative governance. Well, it turns out that governance is a little lower on the issues that were critical to the women in Africa and critical to the women, but it was fascinating that in all cases, in Christianity, in Judaism, and in the Muslim faith, it was the hunkering down of the control of those organizations that was oppressing women, and that it wasn't confined to one faith or another. All three of the monolithic religions in the world were having a more conservative overlay, which was having a very negative effect on women. So to me, it's money, it's the capacity to have education, access to health care, and then to dream about how you get to govern yourselves. Violence against women was the most universal element of oppression in those places.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to take a shot at that question? Or
I'd like to take a
Senator
shot.
Senator Davis?
I'd just like to bring it home to us. Sure, all those things that exist still exist, and they are coming along, and they are doing better in a lot of ways than we are right here in the United States. And so we look at it. We have poverty. We have kids being dropping out of school, not getting a fair education. We are now going back to the point that we feel that we shouldn't have public schools, that we should split the money up with private universities and private schools, Christian schools, give vouchers, or whatever you might want to do. We have a lot of problems that's here. We've come a long ways from 1964 and 65 when we were fighting civil rights issues, and we made ground on that. But I just want to go back to my people that came from Africa. When they came here against their free will, they came here because their own people sold them out to the people to bring them to the United States, and then they were in slavery. And, you know, they lived through that slavery for hundreds of years. They did that. But they overcome. They did. And they went on where they got to be free. You're no longer a slave. You're free to go. Some chose to stay there and fight in the Civil War because that's all they knew. Others had moved north and fought on that side. So you had us on both sides. But we didn't maintain our languages. We had to learn a new language within a new world. We didn't know anything that was going on, but they survived. But the problem that we made as African Americans or blacks or Negroes or whatever you want to call them was the fact that they wanted to keep all that from their children, and my parents wanted to keep from me things that they had to go through with, even though they were not in slavery, their parents were in slavery. Mm-hmm. And they tried to protect us from that. And they always told me in my family, you could be anything that you want to be. They weren't talking about the outside influences that was out there because they figured at that time that we were probably going to be segregated all along. And so, you know, what was important in our communities, here and there you had a doctor or a dentist or you had beauticians. You had to have the beauticians. So they looked up to them. And nurses, you had those kinds of things. You talk about going to law school or whatever. You couldn't run for office because you couldn't vote. So they didn't do anything. And they know how to fend for themselves. I know my parents was raised in the country. And they farmed for many, many years. But when the railroad came through the small area where I lived, many of the Negroes moved to town. You know, and they didn't have schools for us when they were out in the country there. But you know what they did? They had churches. And they set up schools in the churches so their kids could have an education. And I know about those normals. You talk about the school where your mother went for 2 years. I didn't know till I was in high school, that some of the teachers that were teaching me had no more than 2 years of college education.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when they cracked down and say, oh, everybody's got to have a four-year degree in order to teach. And then they were out trying to get those degrees and coming back. But you had black kids over here and you had the white kids over here. You went through this situation where the white kids got the books. You got the hand-me-downs of those books. But everything that we needed, if they had to go out to pick cotton or whatever they had to do to get uniforms so their kids could be in the band or play ball or do whatever they want, parents fought hard for their children. And those, some chose to stay in the South, some chose to move north or west, and they did that. But the one thing that they never forgot to teach their children that, yeah, you can be anything that you want to be. You work for it, and that was for girls and boys. It wasn't like, well, all the boys get the education, the girls don't. And when I was growing up, you know, the women were working in as domestic maids and doing other things that, you know, I said I would never do. And my mother said, well, never say what you're never going to do. But do get the education that you need to keep you from being there. But she said, don't never say never. But I knew in my heart, in my soul, as I was growing up, I was not going to do that. It was some other way that I had to go. And many people took that path because many of my cousins and things that moved north, if they got a 12th grade education, they did very well. Because when they got through with that, they went and worked in the department stores and wherever they could get a job. Didn't go off to college. But when we came out of school, we went to college. And not only was our parents interested in us doing that, the community, the black community, gave you money to help you out. You know, I have a sister and a brother, myself, and we all finished college. And when we come out of college, we didn't owe one dime. And it wasn't all by scholarship. I know when we got our first house, my dad saved every receipt that he got for that house when he made that payment. And he was making very little money, but he was a proud man, and he wanted his family to have a house, and he made sure that we had one. And in that town, you know, the first to get a telephone, first to have indoor toilets, running water, all those kinds of things. They did a lot. But do you see where we are now? We are going back. You know, you talk about the ghetto and the cities and the kids are on drugs and on all of these things. And we know what we need to do is to start off educating our kids when they're very young. And here I am down in Juneau fighting right to this day trying to get pre-K education in Alaska. As much money as we have. They said, no, we're putting too much money into education. We can't keep giving the money to education. Everybody have to fend for themselves. Some people have that attitude, even though they're serving in the House and the Senate. They have that attitude. Mm-hmm. Not just in my state, but all over. Denial of kid care, health insurance. We got many children that do not have health insurance. Mm-hmm. Who's paying the bill? All of you. Because when they get sick, they end up in the emergency room. You can't turn them down. You have to treat them. Somebody pay, you pay. But yet, we don't have Denali kid care for our children. We have it right now at 175%, one of the lowest of all the 50 states. Even though the bill was pushed and passed on both sides, the governor vetoed it 4 years ago and said any time that it come back to him, he will still veto it. So we got our problems right here that need to be worked on. So I'm proud that other people are moving up, but we seem to be moving back. Backwards, not forward. And one of the problems that we have is that we did not share with our children the things that we had to overcome in order to get where we were so they may be where they are. And I sit here 12 years in the Senate, 6 years in the House, still trying to hold the door open. First African American to serve in the Senate and still don't have anyone else to come through that door yet. Out of 60 people down there, you have 12 women. 12 women out of the 60.
There's not enough.
When you look at the minorities, you have seven natives. You got one African American. You got one Asian. But it should represent what we have in our population here. Absolutely. More people need to be running for office. More people need to be. I'm not saying that women do better than men, but we do bring a different perspective to the table.
I really think we have to continue to find ways to bring the young people along.
That's what you
and I love the National Women's History Museum. They have a new campaign, and it's called "Don't Tell Me I Can't." And I think that's a wonderful message to these young people. You had an extraordinary family that said there weren't boundaries for you. Not everybody has that. So I think we need to really work with the young on that.
I agree. Senator Lincoln, would you like to comment also?
Thank you. I just needed to make one comment because I know that you were talking about globally. And I'm not as worldly as some of the other ladies around this table, but for Alaska, I think that we have to recognize that we have many different cultures in Alaska, and that what's good for one isn't good for all. And while I'm a very vocal Alaska Native woman,
what I said, mouthy.
No, good. Good.
Would you call them to order, please? I recognize that there are times when I have an elder that always says the men go first in the line for the food. And a couple times I said, I'm already in line. You guys are just going to have to stay back there.
Good.
But I recognize that that is something that's carried on from generation to generation to generation. And how I deal with that, I mean, if I were in a group where somebody said, oh, let's let the men go first, I'd say, yeah, right. But knowing that that is a tradition in some parts of our native culture, in some of the regions, I have to recognize that, and I have to understand why that is, and not that it puts women at a lower level, but there culturally there is history behind that. We have many common denominators, many, worldwide. We have many common denominators in this room of women of many different colors. But there are some differences. And I think we have to recognize that. That's all I'm saying, that I can't be mouthy and just go out and expect everybody to be the same. And so I wanted to just add that.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit, kind of stay on that theme. Women in the United States have certainly assumed more leadership roles in society. They're still, however, in charge of the majority of housework and child rearing. When all of you were working on your educations and your work as professionals, how did you figure out that aspect of your lives? And has it changed? Or are you watching, if you have daughters or daughters-in-law, are you watching those women do the same thing, where they're out working all day and then still coming home and having to take care of the majority of the home life? Anyone want to take that?
I think that's very true of most of us. I have a daughter now who's running the gold mine in Girdwood, Crow Creek Mine, and she has a baby that's a year old and an intelligent five-year-old, and she does everything. She shows people how to pan. She goes down to the creek with them. She stays home and does, the laundry, or comes to town and do laundry. But she's an incredible woman. I have a lot of respect for her.
Well, Georgiana, I think that we have to recognize, too, that there's a lot of single women that are raising a family. that there isn't a male counterpart in the family. And even in Juno, we always recognized that we were multitasked. We could do it. And I think, you know, I've talked with many, many, many women, some that, like I said, I have to be gentle sometimes, and where there isn't that balance in the family. And I was just sharing with Jane that my sister was up and stayed with me for a month. And she said to me about 3 weeks into staying there, and Arliss, don't you say anything about this now. She said, Georgiana, do you know how lucky you are to have Chris?
Oh, well, I think you are.
And I said to her, do you know how lucky he is to have me? So I think that it's, you know, and she caught herself after, you know, after I said that. Yeah, I guess you're right, that there is a balance there. But because it's what Betty was saying, even though I didn't live back in 1838, my grandmother helped to raise us. My mother was raised by that same grandmother who worked so hard, did everything by candlelight, no electricity, no running water, and had 13 children. And a barge once a year. So that teaching still continues through me to my daughter of some of the things that went on of when I wasn't even around. But so we have to just stop and pause sometimes, I think, on why we are the way we are and why we're so strong, too. But I think we can multitask, and sometimes it's easier to just do it.
That's so true, so true. Anyone else want that, or are we ready to move on a little bit?
Yeah, but right. I surely do believe in that strength from a mother.
And I had that, and I think that becomes part of your bones, and you're very, very lucky if you have a mom that can give that care. That doesn't solve the problem of the world, but I would hope that, and many of them show it, that the women can be strong. And it takes time, but I would hope that it happens, and I think it will happen a lot because of women imparting that strength to their sons and daughters.
Let's talk a little bit about when there's an awareness about gender as an issue. I spent a lot of time when I was young being very resentful that there was an expectation that I couldn't do a lot of the things that the boys did. And so I fought all the time in high school about why can't the girls be on the wrestling team? Why can't they play football? I raised horses all my life and spent time as a wrangler in the Dakotas and had a terrible time being accepted by the male wranglers because even though I could ride as well as them and do the same things, they didn't like me being there. And so I wonder, I had to ride faster and work cattle harder than they did just to be even, you know, passively ignored. What has been your experience in this regard? When was there a time in either your education, your early education, or early careers that you, maybe a job interview, that you really realized that gender was an issue? And I know that sometimes it could have been presented as a good thing, but it's never felt that way to me. It's always been uncomfortable if that became an issue. Victoria, did you want
to
comment?
Yeah, well, my other life is as a conductor. And this is certainly an area where women were not accepted easily. And still there's less resistance now, but there still is some. And when I first started to conduct, the very first orchestra I conducted was the Senior Citizens Orchestra of Los Angeles. And these people were not only old enough to be my parents, they were old enough to be my grandparents. And they were absolutely wonderful and very encouraging. But their music director was of the old school. And he said, well, nice little girl, it's all lovely that you should want to do this now. But when you grow up and you get married, your husband won't let you go to rehearsals. So that's all I needed to hear. I love it when somebody throws the gauntlet down. So all through my conducting career, I was the first woman at Juilliard to get a doctorate. I was the first woman in the Exxon Arts Endowment conductor with a professional orchestra, major orchestra, the Pittsburgh Symphony. And all through there were naysayers. I remember the headline in the Pittsburgh paper when I was first got the position with Pittsburgh, "She's no bigger than a bass fiddle." They thought this was very cute. And so, I mean, the idea of being a woman and being young and being small, all of those were total negatives when it came to the authority that somebody expected from a conductor. And I think, you know, the whole idea of power and authority are something that people consider, and of course these women here are in positions of power and authority, that, you know, undermining that is a very subtle thing. The prejudice right now can't be blatant, but I think it's still there, and I think it's subtle.
Mm-hmm. Other examples of times when you realized that gender was an issue and maybe it was uncomfortable?
I had kind of a funny issue. We had a gold miner that came down to the mine, and he was going to mine whether we liked it or not. And so it was getting kind of heated on the porch, and my husband said, "Go get the gun, honey." Because the guy had a gun on his hip. So I went into the house. Do you think I came out with a gun? No, I came out with a frying pan. And it was a big, heavy metal frying pan. And I would have whacked that son of a gun on the head, without a doubt. But that's, anyway, that was my...
Senator Lincoln.
I'm anxious to hear from the others here, but I always felt that down in Juneau, when the men would huddle, and then I'd go over to find out what the huddle was about, and I would get these strange looks like, "What are you doing here?" Like I wasn't a part of that team. And I, even the when I left in 04, I still felt that it was the men's powerhouse, and that we just happened to be there, but as was pointed out, that we were in the minority. But I have to say that Arliss was a big influencing factor to me in Juneau, and she was an R. Or she, yes. And
I was.
I start to say is. And was, you know, to see her be the powerhouse, and to, she was someone that I looked up to, that, well, of course I can do that, you know, because I could see that she was doing it. And so I think that it's really important also to have role models.
You know, Georgiana, I really, that touches me because I didn't know that. But one thing I found, that many of the women, or some of the women, felt they had to play a role they would defer. They would look up, because usually the leadership was on the dais, they would look up with this look, even hands behind the back, gazing upon the leaders. And there were some kind of tough old gals. I don't know how many of you knew the late Senator Betty Fahrenkamp.
Oh, yeah.
But she could play poker with the boys. Yeah. I didn't play poker with the boys. But she stood up, and she was very strong, and I was affected. We were dear friends. And so I think that you either have that inherent strength, but you always learn from others and take from others. And I don't see anybody in this table that I look as they're having deferred. Nice, but don't defer.
You know, this is Jane Amdick. I just wanted to say that Arliss is the first woman who ran for governor in Alaska. And it created the belief by young girls and middle-aged women that this was possible.
You're not giving me credit for Sarah Palin, are you?
Well, here's what I think.
Sorry, Jane.
I think that you and Fran Ulmer broke trail for Sarah Palin. And that in your races for governor and in Fran's race for governor, there were many people who said, can a woman do that? I don't know if a woman can do that job. And that question was not posed by people who were looking at her candidacy 16 years later. So I'm saying you broke trail and set up a series of expectations for what are the jobs that women can do. Could they be governor? And so I think you are very responsible for many young women believing that they have a role in elected public office in this state. And so I say thank you to you for that, because you taught me as a very young woman that women can do anything, and that the key to success in many political environments is to volunteer to write the first draft and to take the minutes. Therefore, you are setting the stage against which everyone else has to reflect.
Before we move on to your response, Senator Davis, I just wanted to say thank you. We've reached an hour, and we are going to continue, but I just wanted to say thank you so much to our panelists, Senator Arliss Sturgiolowski, sitting Senator Betty Davis, former Assembly Chair Jane Anvik, Senator Georgiana Lincoln, Victoria Bond, composer and conductor and writer of Mrs. President, and Representative Cynthia Tuohy. Thank you so much for being with us.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with former Senator Arliss Sturgiolowski, sitting Senator Betty Davis, former Anchorage Assembly Chair Jane Anvik, former Senator Georgiana Lincoln, former Representative Cynthia Tuohy, and composer Victoria Bond. Hosted by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in partnership with the Anchorage Opera, the women took part in a panel discussion on women in America, changing roles, challenging times, defining the future. APRN's news director Lori Townsend served as moderator of the panel, recorded in the Alaska Public Television studios on Monday, September 24th, 2012. If you would like to listen to the entire event, including questions from the audience, you can listen on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.
Please do.
Since we're talking political, now I just want to add to that, and I just want to say to all of you that's present, or you that's listening on the radio and what we're saying, one of the problems that we have as females, that females in a lot of cases like to think that they have to pattern themselves after the men who are in politics. Yes. And you don't have to.
No.
Sure, everybody need to work together and everybody need to have respect for each other, but it doesn't mean that the only way that you can get ahead is that you do what they do. Because I was so shocked when I came to Juneau in 1991 and you had people down there like Arliss Sturgiolowski, and you had Fran Ulmer, you had Kay Brown and a whole lot of the other women there. I can't call all their names, but very dynamic women, outstanding women, could have been anything that they wanted to be. And at that time, none of them were serving in leadership. And even if you look around today, you look on the House side, it's Republican-led. They do have Democrats in it, but it's Republican-led. It's not a coalition. On the other side, you have the coalition. Because we worked our way up to a 10-10 split, you can't organize without having at least 11 people, and 11 people you can't hold. We were able to have six Republicans come over with the Democrats and make a 16 out of 20 coalition. It works. But you know, in most states, they have one position that is not necessarily held by females, but a lot of females end up moving up the ladder by holding that position. And for three sessions, I have introduced a piece of legislation that nobody need to have to vote on but us, because the public really don't understand it well enough to say, yeah, we support it, don't support it. And we have in our constitution, state constitution, Senate pro tem or representative pro tem. And all that person do in this state is when we come down to organize, that person holds the seat while the person that's going to be the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate, his vote is taken, and you have the gavel at that time, and that's it. In other states, they are part of the leadership. So you don't just have the Speaker, and you don't just have the chairs of the committees that's on there, and down the line, but you look at it, you could have that person in the leadership. And the duties was to be assigned by the president or the speaker. It wasn't something brand new that they would make up and they had to follow that. And do you know, it took me all those times to pass that bill out of the Senate over to the House, and it got to the House and it died over there because they wouldn't put it to the floor because they didn't want to add to the leadership. And that's where women make their mistakes when they don't speak out for what we should be doing. And so that is a big problem. And if you're ever going to run for office, you need to know that and be aware of that. You know how the men used to be bragging when I went down to Juneau, how their wives take care of them? And I looked at them like this. I said, I have a wife also. My husband is my wife, and he takes care of me. You know, so that can work both ways. It works both ways. All men don't want you to have to take care of them. They want to do things to please their wives and help them out. So that works very well. But what I'm saying is, just like the Women's Commission, we shouldn't have to have a Women's Commission, because if we had equal rights in every way and equal pay and all these other things, we wouldn't have to have it. But we don't have it. And did you know that bill was pushed to the floor until it got over there in the House on the night that we closed out? And rather than vote on it, they shut down? So you have to start all over again to do that? If you had a woman in charge, that would not have happened. You know, on the Democratic side, there has never been a Democratic female to serve as Speaker or the President of the Senate. Only Republican women, and only three of them.
I have one more question that I'd like to ask, and then I'm sure that there's folks here that have questions, and I'd like to allow time for that. Mm-hmm. My final question is kind of self-serving because it's about the media. I remember years ago having a friend of mine who is a Native woman from Montana. Oh, I'm sorry. Talking about reflections in the media of ourselves and how women are portrayed in media, and whether or not we've made any progress. I try not to watch television, but sometimes you see it anyway. It's everywhere. And there's a commercial on right now that I would just like to throw something through the screen every time I see it, because it's a man that sits for a timer for 5 seconds with his mouth clamped shut while his wife rattles on about some, you know, nonsense about people they met at a dinner party. And when he gets to the 5-second mark, a buzzer goes off and he wins a big prize because he's been able to be quiet for 5 seconds while his wife chatters nonsense. It's unbelievable that we're still seeing these types of images. But a friend of mine, my native friend from Montana, told me one time that more troubling to her was that she doesn't ever see reflections of her people in the media. And it struck me because, you know, being a white kid growing up in a small white village that I didn't think about those things, of course, until I got older. But that stuck with me all these years, realizing that not only are women portrayed quite poorly, and still are, prancing around, you know, how they do in commercials and always at home making dinner for the husbands that are arriving, but also there's not good reflections of Native women, of African-American women. What are your thoughts about the reflections of women in media and the way we're portrayed, both today and it doesn't seem like it's getting any better to me. It seems like we're almost, you know, we're in this snooky bimboism era of how women are portrayed on television.
I've been watching CNN a lot because of the problems of the world. There are an incredible amount of women on CNN. You've got to watch it.
You mean as announcers?
As announcers, commentators, I think it's wonderful. Yeah,
that's good to know.
It's not just CNN. There's a whole lot of women, more women now in the media than it has in past years. Of course, it's not 50-50 if you're trying to get to that level. But you see more and more of them showing up on all the channels.
Well, I guess
from my
I watch the good stuff.
I watch... you know,
PBS. That's good.
And CNN and so on, where women are there and doing a very credible job.
But you know, Georgiana, how we change this is by having panels like this and having it on the air and talking about it.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure that out there in the listening audience, if not here in this room, women are going, gosh, I didn't think about that. You know, and I think that the more that it's discussed of women in all roles, and that we will see more changes at a more rapid pace. But it just reminds me of the old adage that when women vote, women win. And women just have to get out there and vote. I mean, that's really critical because that's where you see a lot of the change, too. When you talk about the media, the gavel to gavel in Juneau, I never got up on the floor to really talk to the other 19 senators. Never. Because I was in the minority, as I said.
Oh.
But who I was talking to was that little dinky camera that was turned to me when I was speaking. Yeah. So I was really talking to all of Alaska.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of good comments back from not just the folks that I represented, but I figured that I represented the whole state.
Yeah.
And I think that the women on this panel always felt that too, that it wasn't just our little corner. But it reminded me of at the University of Fairbanks, I wrote a paper on that, on how Native Americans are portrayed. And in all the books that I researched, all I saw was this American Indian man in a suit, tie, and the wife serving dinner at this formal dining room table with a girl and a boy. And I thought, gosh, that's not the way I remember us growing up, you know? But the media, whether it is the TV, the radio, or the printed media, they often don't depict women in positively. You know, if you look at the stories, it's very condescending, I think.
They didn't condescend to me, damn it.
Well, but you, that's why you were a role model, don't you understand? But I want to say, as being a role model, I don't want to forget my mother, who, and we all talk about mothers, and isn't that strange that we don't talk about our fathers? Mm-hmm. But my mother was the first U.S. magistrate in Rampart. And she often told us that the reason that she won was because this old traitor that was there said he was going to be the magistrate. Uh-huh. And she decided she was going to be the magistrate. And he said, Kitty, you can't be the magistrate. You're Indian and you're a woman. And so you will never get the magistrate. And she won handedly. So, you know, that was really a positive influence to us kids, too. And as Betty pointed out, what a shame that we don't have more minority women in the legislators. I sadly say that I am still the first Alaska Native woman ever elected to the Senate. And that's sad to say in 2012. You know, I never say that as, you know, I'm the first. That's just real sad to me. Mm-hmm. And we just have to get, you look at the low voter turnout. Get the women, get our women to the polls, and you'd see a much different looking faces down there in Juneau and even on the national level and your assemblies and schools.
Get the women to run.
Well, yeah. But there's ways that we can do that, and I think that we haven't done all we can as women.
You know, you shouldn't be feeling bad about being the first. The problem is if being the only. You know, I was the first. You was the first. For natives, for African Americans. But I'm the only and you're the only. You keep holding the door open and hoping that other people will step in. And I tell people, I don't want you to vote for me because of my color. I don't want you to necessarily vote for me because I'm a female. I want you to vote for me because of the work that I do.
Right.
But I don't want you not to vote because I am black and I am female.
Right. So let's, I can tell that we've got lots of questions here.
We like to hear them.
It's hard to know where to start. But this lady here looks like she's had her hand up for quite a while, so yeah. Go ahead.
Janet Mitzen, and I'll declare my credentials. I'm a 60s liberal in my 60s. But my hat's off to the members of this panel, for the women who have been in public life. You represent everything I would hope for, which is regardless of your party affiliations, you have public policy positions for which you have fought ardently on behalf of all of us and our families, and done it with great credibility, and I thank you. But this gets at the heart of my question. Senator Lincoln, Senator Davis, you both observed that women in elected office will bring a different perspective. And then if more women would vote, we would have more women in office. And I'm pleased to see within the state, within the nation, that the numbers are growing. And so I think, okay, let me celebrate that. But then I pause because I'm very troubled by the predominance of women who are coming into public office who are anathema to everything that I believe in. Mm-hmm. Predominantly, the women who are being elected with a hard right perspective. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Here, here.
It does not take us forward. It does, in fact, seek to take us back to things that make my knees go weak, that would make my mom's knees go weak if she were still alive, to see us walking away from hard-fought battles in hard-won rights. And so my question to anyone on the panel who chooses to do it is, why do you think that is happening? And what do you believe it takes on all of our part to successfully elect to office more women who voice moderate and progressive voices?
Excellent
money.
Question.
Money. I mean, number one, it's money. Number two, it's money. Number three, it's
money.
And I say that not as a woman who has run for office and lost and won, ran for office and won, that the amount of money that is required to participate in electoral offices now just increases exponentially. So the structure of how you get the money now has changed as well. So number one is money, but then number two, since there'll be unequal amounts of money in terms of maybe corporate interests now have the ability to flood into the political structure, and so they might have a different point of view than gender equality, civil rights, education. And so what we really need is boots on the ground. And I think that what that means is it's a call to people to volunteer their time, to assist campaigns, to knock on doors, to assist with the development of web pages, because our entire political structure in this democracy are at risk of people being apathetic and pulling back instead of moving, surging forward to be engaged. And so the whole nation, I think, and in Alaska is a reflection of that. People are confused about how to regain their government, and it has to be shoe leather, people giving time to candidates, people giving energy to candidates, because I don't think we're going to be able to meet them dollar for dollar. And so a progressive agenda associated with particularly gender equality, I think it requires people power in political campaigns. And the other part, I think, is teaching our children that they have some responsibility, some civic responsibility to be engaged, that we take our kids with us or our grandchildren when we're going door to door to show them, to demonstrate that, so that they too believe that they can have a voice. But the political structure has changed so that it is not too surprising that in many respects it reflects where the money came from and what interests are being supported.
Hear, hear.
Mm. Yes. I want to make a comment and a request of everybody, not just the panels. I am a, quote, little old lady who sits behind the polls, an election judge. In the state of Alaska, all over the state, the elections allow, by law, a youth worker. That means boy or girl, 16 and 17, they have to be 16 or 17. They cannot be 18. They must be in school. They can be homeschooled, but they must be in school. They can work at the polls. They get paid just like the little old lady sitting next to them. They can, and I say that in jest because it's, oh yeah, I know who you're talking about. Contact the Division of Elections in your community. Whether, if you know your polling worker, call them. Ask them. If you know a teenager, tell them. Call the Division of Elections. It's great on their resume. Most kids, they have to take the whole day off school. They work from, just like the rest of us, from 6 o'clock in the morning till at least 10 o'clock at night, because you have to balance and close it out. Then they, most of the time, will get extra credit. They don't just to say, woohoo, I get out of school. But that's something that the media, you said you don't watch television, shame on you, you're representing the TV station. You should be should be talking about that. You want youth to get involved? Well, this is a way they can see what goes on behind the curtain, to use an arts phrase. If you don't know what's going on behind the curtain, it's sometimes hard to understand what's happening in front of the curtain. I'm not going to dwell on the election, the municipal election, but there weren't very many youth workers.
Well, I appreciate you telling us about that, because that's actually a story that I can assign someone to go after leading into this election. Yeah.
Because the election isn't that far away.
Yeah, so I certainly will do that. Yes, a question.
In your defense, she doesn't work for a TV station. She's a radio station.
That's okay. That's all right. I can take
good
the heat.
Good point. I'm sorry, Jean. Yes.
More
good
questions.
Point.
Yes.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you, Jean.
I'm Bill Storm, and I'm representing the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission. So thanks so much to KAKM for hosting this wonderful event. And my question would be, we're going to be faced with the question, should we have a constitutional convention?
No.
What does your panel think about opening that Pandora's box?
Well, analysts. My, that's a good question.
I'll take a shot at that. At the point where we are now, I'm not interested in us having one, because I'm fearful of what would take place if we have it. And so that's just my opinion.
Anyone else?
Jane Anvik. My opinion is it's not broken, and the risks associated with changing a small part that you may have an interest in changing is risking the entire document that really provides for tremendous capacity for Alaska to be able to control its natural resources, and for Alaska's judiciary to be above, not elected, and for the citizens of Alaska to be well served. So I wouldn't open it up at all. And of course, I would live with a guy who, I'm married to a fellow who helped write the Constitution, and I've learned well about the relative value of the elements of the Constitution.
And you don't have to have a Constitution convention to change the Constitution.
Yes.
No, there's initiative and referendum, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think it just opens it up, and I don't see any issues. This has been before us every 10 years, so we've had it for a number of times. I don't see issues rising, really, that merit bring the whole issue of the Constitution before us. So I have been a consistent no.
This is Jane. The same money that is influencing elections would also influence the composition of the Constitutional Convention.
Absolutely. Right. Victoria, did you want to comment?
Injecting a note of humor in this, I did write an opera about the Constitutional Convention of 1787, which was called A More Perfect Union, and it was probably the most contentious moment in American history.
Wow.
No one could agree on anything.
Excellent. Yeah, I think we'd see some of that. Yes.
Good evening, ladies. My name is Michelle Scannell, and I am currently running for State House.
Yeah, good for you. Ladies, get out your checks.
Yes. I'm running for the Jewel Lake, Sand Lake, Campbell Lake area of Anchorage. I love and resolve the Lake District. And my question for you tonight is, you've all mentioned stories about overcoming oppression. And I was wanting to get your take on this current movement of fellow women in my position that are supporting legislation that directly negatively impacts women's daily lives. And it seems to be a growing phase that's becoming a louder and stronger voice in office.
What do you mean?
The Tea Party.
Senator Davis mentioned earlier, a constant negative voice about supporting things like access to health care for their children, access to quality education, access to health care for their own bodies, access to higher education, affordable living. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Well, I guess you could certainly have a litany,
yes.
But unless you get into a position of power where you can bring others to your point of view, change will not happen. That's why, isn't it, that you're running for office? Is to gain some ability to impact those things? You got to be part. You don't have to join negative things, but you have to be there in order to affect change.
Well, that's why I want to go down to June.
Well, that's your answer. Yeah.
All right. Other questions? Yes.
Well, I don't have a question, but I would like to tell this body that these ladies on the dais have all either are actively involved with the Women's Political Caucus, or they either presently or they have been. A couple of them, Arliss and Cynthia, were original founders of the organization.
Was
this
I?
Year, no, Cynthia was.
Well, sort of. I mean, they were there. There were long ago people. At any rate, we have long ago. Sorry, ladies.
I'm an old goat.
Well, we have 11 people from our caucus running for the legislature this year.
Right.
And I know there are several other young people, but young and middle-aged women that are running on the Republican, not so progressive as we have. But they're, to answer the question that you were talking about that these ladies have discussed, there's plenty of people out there for you to get behind. And they need your help. They need your voice. They need you knocking on the doors. And they need your money. And to just know that you're behind them. So whoever is in your area, there's Loopy, there's what's her name? There's 11 that I know of, and there are a lot more. So get off your dust and go support them, because these women have a lot to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for a couple more questions?
Eleanor's
yes.
Boy, am I a minority.
Yeah.
That's good.
Important things were said about the influences of parents and other persons who said to at least some of the women here that they could do anything, be anything. And this morning on MSNBC, Andrea Mitchell was interviewing Condoleezza Rice, and she said the same thing. My mother told me I could be anything. I could be president. And she was growing up in the segregated Alabama.
Oh.
My question is, what do we say and what can we do to assist, enable, if that's the right word, the very many women who are single or divorced and have children and don't have that positive influence that have helped each of you get to be on the panel? Because I'm more and more aware, and in some personal relationships with women who have been held back and never got at a young age and aren't getting enough now of what they can do. Maybe someone would speak to that.
I hear the answer that, this is Georgiana, but I hear the answer I was going to give. And that I've said over and over and over again when I talk with especially the young people, and young gets older now to me. But I've always said, I want to be your mentor. Call me. Here's my phone number. Here's my email. I want to be your mentor. And I think one person was the only one that ever called and took me up on that. But we have to get out there and say, we are here for you too. We can't just sit and wait for somebody to come knocking at our doors. And I'm trying to think, and I'm looking to Jane for help here, but I was thinking of the boy, not the Boys and Girls.
Girls Club.
Club, no, the where you have big brothers, big sisters. Mm-hmm. That every time I see that ad, I think, I've got to do that. I've got to do that. And I haven't yet, but we need to get out there and help, especially those that you talk about that maybe didn't have the chance that we had of having a parent, whether it was a mother or a father, to be a really critical, important, positive part of our lives. Because there's many, many, many out there that are involved in the violence cycle.
Sarah Ashcroft. This is for Senator Betty Davis. Do you see yourself developing allies with other female senators to push the Alaskan agenda, whether it's more money for K-12 education or for female adult education?
I do that every day.
Sure you do.
Who are you?
I chair a health and social services committee because I am that in that majority coalition, and I'm also vice chair of education. But those are my, and I serve also on labor, and I'm on veteran and military affairs, but forever working in that light. And I always have interns coming to my office to work, not only just the one you pick up from the university, but when I come back home to my city, I get high school students to come into my office and work, and it's paid out of a salary from me, not from the state. And I've worked hard for scholarships and put on youth conferences and parents' conferences in order to involve people. You talk about what do to help single parents that don't have all the things that I might have because I have a husband or I have other resources, and they don't. The main thing that we have to do is to make sure that they get a decent education. Because when people are educated, they know that they can move forward into something. And that's why it's so important. Our kids are our greatest resources. And you, what we all need to be pushing for is no way we should sit around and not say, we want pre-K for our children in this state. It's voluntary. If you don't want your child to come, fine. We can't force them. But it ought to be provided. And you know, when you vote, that gives you the authority to have control over those people that are serving in the legislature. You see, you go and vote for us, and many of you don't hear from me anymore. You don't follow the issues. And if you ask how everybody's doing, usually the person that's from my area might say, oh, she's doing just fine. The person across in the other area might say, no, she's not. So you don't really depend on us by sharing with us what your concerns and your issues are and your needs are so that we can work as partners. And that's why I say I might be representing a small district, but the laws that we make affect everybody in this state. So I represent all of you, regardless of where you live.
Let's take one more question, and then I don't want to tax our panelists for too long.
It's more a comment. You know, it goes on throws have been around for a long time.